Welcome to Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This is episode 5 and is part 2 of a conversation with Ray McGovern. We spoke via Skype on January 26, 2017. We start part 2 by continuing our conversation about John Podesta's emails. John Podesta was the chairman of the 2016 Hillary Clinton presidential campaign.
This is what Obama said at his very last press conference, okay? Quote, "The conclusions of the intelligence community with respect to Russian hacking were not conclusive regarding WikiLeaks." Whoa. Oh, so we have not conclusive conclusions. What does that mean? Well, that means that there's a huge gap that Obama is admitting to in saying the Russians were hacking, but how did that stuff get to WikiLeaks? And I can tell you, because I know, it wasn't a hack. It was a leak. A leak is when you put a little thumb drive in your computer, right? Somebody at the Democratic National Committee did that and leaked it to, I mean, I don't know that 100%.
And what was their motivation? I've heard people say it was because they were disillusioned because of Hillary cheating Bernie Sanders out of the nomination.
Well, that's I don't know that for sure, but that's the most reasonable explanation I can conceive of. That was the DNC hacks. Now, with respect to the Podesta hacks, he was an agent of the Saudi government. I mean, he was he was lobbying for them. And ipso facto, NSA would have all of his correspondence between himself and the Saudis. So somebody apparently looked at that, maybe an NSA, and said, you know, this is really, really bad. Not only are they sort of making sure that Bernie can't win, but this is awful, this stuff. And it was awful, the content, if you look at it. And so somebody there put in a little thumb drive or whatever they do and got it somehow to WikiLeaks. The Russians, do they hack? Of course they hack. Everybody hacks. But what Americans don't realize is that there is no, well, thank Obama for it, no conclusive proof that the Russians gave anything to Julian Assange. And when people say, oh, Julian Assange, how do you believe him? Well, I believe him. He's a friend of mine.
I don't think he's ever been caught fabricating any evidence or deliberately lying.
Yeah, if you see some evidence of that, I'd like to see it because I don't know. And what he releases, you know, he doesn't mess around with it. He's been criticized by people like Ed Snowden, who say, you know, Julian, you really ought to take off the Social Security numbers and the MasterCard numbers. And Julian says, and I think he's right. Look. Once you alter any of these documents in any way at all, even the metadata on top, it's no longer pristine pure. And Julian can brag of having such a record for pristine purity with these emails that they are used in courts of law to get people out of jail or prevent them from getting into jail. He doesn't want to sacrifice that, even if it means some people's Social Security numbers are divulged to other people. So, if you want to laugh at Julian Assange, well, you know, compare him with James Clapper, who lied under oath 4 years ago, okay, Senate Intelligence Committee, and up until last week, he was still Director of National Intelligence. You tell me what that means.
It means that if you are on the right side of the politics, you can get away with anything and not suffer any punishment whatsoever.
Well, it also means what Schumer, Chuck Schumer, said in an inadvertent outburst of candor. He said, you know, President-elect Trump, he's doing something very foolish in crossing the CIA. Now, this is a direct quote, Wilton. The CIA has 6 ways to Sunday to retaliate for that kind of thing. So this is very foolish. And I would have thought that a smart businessman would avoid antagonizing an element such as the CIA. End quote. Chuck Schumer, minority leader in the U.S. Senate, is telling the president-elect they really ought to be afraid of the CIA because they have, quote, six ways to Sunday to get even with them. Well, that speaks volumes.
Well, I noticed that Trump has retained his own security.
Yeah, well.
So maybe he listened to Schumer.
Well, I've never seen it so outwardly stated before, but when you look at what happened to John Kennedy when he wanted to deal with the Russians.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a bad precedent.
And speaking of Trump, I mean, I'm by no stretch of the imagination a fan of Trump, but he must have some redeeming qualities if the deep state hates him so much. You know, he must be thwarting their plans in some way. And I think, you know, maybe in saying that he wants better relations with Russia, that could have a lot to do with it. Although I will temper that by saying that I don't necessarily believe anything Trump says. I'd rather look at what he does than what he says, because he can contradict himself in the space of 30 seconds.
Well, that's correct. And I always preface my remarks about Trump with precisely those words. But, you know, if he talks to the Russians, I mean, the worst thing that could happen to the military, industrial, congressional, deep state outfit here is peace breaking out. I mean, if peace breaks out, that is very bad for business.
Right. War industries can't make any money on peace.
No. And if you know, we said about NATO for this last while, well, is NATO obsolete? Well, yes, it is obsolete. It's been obsolete since the Warsaw Pact dissolved. And that was way back, right after the Berlin Wall fell. So what about NATO? Well, it's not necessary.
I think it still serves a political purpose, which is that I think geopolitically, the Western Europe and Russia should be natural allies. So the United States wants to have this hostility between the two of them. By keeping Europe in NATO, it keeps the two from getting together.
Well, that's true. And
it isolates Russia.
Yeah, I agree to that. But I think the West Europeans are getting a little smarter now. The British are out. And without the British in there, you know, our twins who really salute whenever we say whatever, Western Europe's going to have to grow up. And when I'm in Germany, despite the best advice of my German friends, I ask them, hey, you know, it's time that you started acting like adults. It's 72 years now since the end of the war. We can understand you acting like children or adolescents for the first couple of decades, but seven decades? Come on. Look at your own interests there. Sanctions? What are they producing? They give me all kinds of problems, not only to Russia, but to your own people.
Right. They're producing unemployment in Europe.
Yeah. And so I think gradually, it's far more gradual than I would have expected from very enlightened people. But gradually, if who knows, if Trump says, I'm going to talk with Vladimir Putin and I'm going to say to him, your spokesman suggested 2 months ago that we pull back those troops right on the Polish border with Russia. We're going to do that. Will you withdraw your troops? And Putin told me, yeah. Okay. Well, that's a first step. Now, how about the other things we can do to reduce tensions? Does anyone really think the Russians want to attack the Baltic states? Maybe there's some people in the Baltic states that do. Of course, they have a very sad history with Russia. But I don't think any rational person will see any reason why Russia would want to invade the Baltic states. So
now, Russia's military posture is overwhelmingly defensive.
Well, yeah, and for good reason. And, you know, one little anecdote. I think that when you talk about Vladimir Putin, when you think about him, you think about not only a marvelous chess player, but a person who has acted in a very restrained way with remarkable sang-froid during this whole crisis over Ukraine and everything else. As a matter of fact, he has even kept a sense of humor, because after the plebiscite in Crimea, he was explaining at one of these long press conferences that he has, he explained, you know, our problem was this, NATO and Crimea, We didn't want to be in the situation where we would have to apply to NATO to have our sailors visit the NATO ports in Crimea. We're sure that the NATO guys are just wonderful fellows, but we really like to have it the same way it is now, where we're happy to welcome them into our ports on visits in Sevastopol and Crimea. Thank you very much. Well, you know.
Yeah, quite a sense of humor and sarcasm there.
Yeah, so, and of course, what bothers him most is the anti-ballistic missile emplacements all around Russia's periphery, in Romania, in Poland, in the Black Sea, in the Baltic. What's that all about? And the Russians have ample reason to be suspicious about that, because we know that when Dmitry Medvedev was president back in 2012, he graced the president with a suggestion there. They were at a summit, one of these large summits. It was in Seoul, South Korea. And Medvedev said, and how do we know this? Well, this wasn't WikiLeaks. This was the ABC microphone that was left on, okay?
I hadn't heard about that.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. You can hear Medvedev say, now look, we are really concerned about this anti-ballistic missile stuff, okay? And Vladimir has told me, Putin, to ask you about that. When are we going to start talking about that? Because we don't see, you know, we really don't think it's designed to protect against nuclear missiles from Iran, especially now that there's no prospect that Iran will get any such thing in 10 years. And so let's talk about that. And what Obama says, oh, yeah, all right, well, sure, we'll do that. First, let me get reelected, okay? And then we'll talk about that, okay? Now, that's picked up on the microphone, right? Now, did Obama live up to that promise? There's no indication at all. Why? Because the anti-ballistic missile system production is the, well, I would call it the most lucrative corporate welfare plan in the history of mankind. Billions and billions of dollars allocated to this every single year for a system that most engineers and scientists assure me will never work or can easily be defeated by any number of very simple decoys, and yet they keep doing it.
There's too much money in it to quit. And the risk that it poses to the human race and human civilization is seen by them as an externality.
Well, that's right. Because, you know, if you look, now, you know, I was running the Soviet foreign policy branch back in the 70s. And Nixon and Kissinger said, you know, we think we can play this China card in such an adroit way that we get some strategic arms talks and maybe conclusions with the Russians. And we said, yeah, we think that would work. And sure enough, in May 1972, when I was there in Moscow, when Nixon came and signed the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Now, that was an incredible factor for balance and for mutual understanding that neither side could attempt a first strike with nuclear weapons without fully expecting a retaliatory blow ipso facto, okay? That's what it did. It limited each side to two anti-ballistic missile systems installations, which, of course, would never be enough to cover a whole country. In a couple of months, they reduced it to one. And, you know, the thing was a factor for stability up until 2001, when George W. Bush came into office and got out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, revoked it, said, well, we're out of here, okay? Now that situation is an incredible factor for instability. And so when Putin, again, when he explained the annexation, I think that's the proper word, actually, annexation of Crimea, he said, you know, NATO, the prospect that Ukraine could come into NATO, that was one factor. But far more important was the anti-ballistic missile system factor. We didn't want anti-ballistic missile installations in Sevastopol, in Crimea, anywhere else in the Black Sea. We can't prevent it on naval craft, but we were determined to prevent it in Crimea. Now, Putin said that. And so why are we building this? Now, this is kind of sort of interesting because it was very, very unusual. We had an ambassador in Moscow. His name was Jack Matlock. He's a good friend of mine. As a matter of fact, he was responsible for me being able to be there in Moscow for the signing of the ABM Treaty. My branch had worked very hard to make that possible and to reassure Nixon. Now, this is before Reagan, to reassure Nixon that if he trusted, we could verify. And we could, and we did. So anyhow, Jack Matlock is at Valdai, one of these big conferences with high Russian officials, high press, high academics and all. This is 2 years ago. And the subject of the ABM treaty comes up, and Jack Matlock's on the panel there, the dais, and so is Vladimir Putin. And Putin says, "Now, Mr. Matlock, what about Bush getting out of the ABM treaty?" And Matlock says, "Oh, yeah, I was against that. That was a very foolish move." And Putin says, "Yeah, but why?" And Matlock's very defensive. He says, "Well, it's not against you. It's actually a jobs program." Putin looks at him and he says, "Mr. Matlock, a jobs program. Has the United States of America no other uses for all the billions of dollars that could be put into infrastructure? A jobs program." Okay, now I'm sure that poor Jack,
totally ridiculous on the face of it to say something like that.
So if you put that together with the fact that, you know, the scientists and engineers, I'm sure, are correct that you can always defeat these systems very quickly. But you put yourself in Putin's place, right? You're sitting around the table there in the Kremlin, and you got your generals, and you got everybody there, and you're going to say, "Look, you know, they're building these systems in Romania and Poland and Black Sea and the Baltic, and actually in Asia now. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, guys. They'll never work."
Well, United States said that these were actually to protect against Iranian missiles, which, again, it was another bald-faced lie. I mean, you can't – it's just totally unbelievable.
Yeah. My point on this little scenario where he's sitting around the table with the generals, he says, don't worry. They don't worry. He can't do that. He can't say that. You know, the generals come back right and say, "Look, you know, we're not responsible for assessing American intentions. We're responsible for assessing Americans' capabilities. That's what military intelligence is all about. And what worries us is if the Pentagon ever gets it into its head that by installing these ABM systems things, which can actually hit some of our ICBM sites in Russia, if they think that they can do a first strike without suffering a retaliatory blow, well, that's very, very, very dangerous. And so don't tell us, Mr. Putin, not to worry, you know."
Well, the U.S. has been actively working toward a first strike capability for a long time, and that is extremely destabilizing.
Yes.
Can you imagine in a crisis? I mean, each side would have such a temptation to be the first to push the button.
Sure, and that's what the ABM treaty was all about. It limited people to, as I said, two sites and then one in each country. And so, you know, when we talk about this, this is really a factor for instability. I know personally that in 1983, it was just, I don't know, providence, God's grace, whatever you say, that prevented a nuclear exchange with Russia. Why? Because our Pentagon, feeling its oats, mounted an exercise that was so similar to what would happen in a real nuclear exchange that if it weren't for some colleagues of mine at the CIA who descended upon Ronald Reagan and said, "Look, you need to call this off. You need to stop this. The Russians are really thinking this is for real." Okay, unless they had done that and intervened, there could have been at the end of 1983 this exchange. So that's how, you know. So if you have a situation where you're not sure you're going to be able to retaliate, then you go back to what used to be called, the term of art is instant retaliation or a launch on warning is what we used to call it. And that means that once you see a flock of geese flying over the North Pole and it looks like an ICBM, you know, there'll be people that will be trigger happy and would like to launch on warning before we lose our retaliatory capability. That's what we would. Now, when you mentioned the fiction that the ABM systems going into Poland and Romania were designed to protect against Iranian missiles, I've never seen Vladimir Putin dismiss the Western press in so harsh a way as when he raised that. And he said, now you're saying that you're still saying that it's against Iran when we have this treaty which prevents Iran from getting this. He said, you know, this is his words. I don't know what to do with you. I'm at it with you guys. He says that.
Right. And he was talking to Western media, Western journalists.
Yeah. So, you know, well, some people say, well, maybe it's to protect against, oh, yeah, that's it, missiles from North Korea. Well, you know, to those people, I suggest that they buy a little globe, you know, which is the shortest way from North Korea to attack on the United States. So it's so transparently, what's the word, disingenuous, that I'm amazed that the Russians are as judicious and as restrained as they are in pointing out that a lot of this stuff just doesn't hold water.
And you know what? I think it's only because the U.S. has a deeply indoctrinated and thoroughly ignorant general population that the United States government can get away with these policies. Because if there was any pushback at home, it wouldn't happen. But people are so indoctrinated.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that because I always try to include saying this, that I've been here in Washington for over 50 years. I've been analyzing Russia for over 60 years. Now, here in Washington, you see a lot of change in 50 years. But there's one change that dwarfs all the other changes in importance, in significance, and that is that we no longer have a free media in any real sense. And that is big. That could not be bigger. You know, the Fourth Estate is dead. Now, people need to know what the Fourth Estate means. That was Edmund Burke, a late 18th century statesman in Britain. At that time, there were three estates in Parliament, two in Commons, one in Lords. And he looked up one day and he said, I'm very proud to be one of the three estates here, but there's a fourth estate. And that is the gentleman here in the balcony, the members of the press, the newspaper writers, because that fourth estate is more important than all three of us put together because they hold us responsible. They keep us honest. They report to the British people what we are doing. That's the fourth estate. That estate is dead. The good news is a fifth estate. And it's just catching on now. People my age, they need a little instruction. They need their grandchildren to take them through the internet. But it's real, real easy. And that will be our salvation. People can find out what's going on if they know where to look.
Well, I read a quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski a while back, and he was more or less complaining or bemoaning the fact that people are waking up. And he thinks that's a bad thing. And he blames it to a significant degree on the internet.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very big danger for them. I remember that Bill Casey, shortly after he came in as the head of the CIA under Ronald Reagan, he was in an early morning meeting, and a friend of mine was there. Okay, so this is firsthand information. And what Casey said was this: when we've persuaded and deceived the American people into believing what we want them to believe, then we will have achieved our mission. He speaks an attitude here, and this is really important. The establishment, the smart people, the Ivy Leaguers like McGeorge Bundy on Vietnam, like all these people that congregated around Obama, see, they know what's best. They know what's best for the country. So if that's the case, then they can use the other establishment figures, like the New York Times hierarchy, because they know what's best for the country too. So, for example, when George W. Bush was running for a second term, James Risen, crackerjack investigative reporter for the New York Times, uncovered the fact that the National Security Agency was grossly violating all our rights under the Fourth Amendment to be protected from illegal searches and seizures, okay? Risen had the story in July 2004. He's the best there is. So he goes to his bosses in the New York Times. He says, man, this is a really good story. We have to get this out. Nothing has been so flagrant since the CIA was doing all those untoward things in the 50s, okay? And his master said, well, we have an election coming up in just 4 months. I don't think we should. I mean, we know what's best for the American people. Why don't you hold on to that? Now, fast forward. That's July 2004, December 2005. James Risen goes to his betters there, and betters usually used at the New York Times. He says, you know, this is a little embarrassing. And my book now is in galley. It's about to come out in 2 weeks. And
what book was that?
The book called The State of War, which had a big chapter which told this whole story about NSA invading our emails, our telephones, and, you know, violating not only the Fourth Amendment, but the FISA law and other things that were introduced to protect us precisely against this. So he's got this chapter in this book, which has other good chapters. And he says, you know, it's coming out, so it's going to be a little embarrassing because you guys are paying me big bucks, you know, to be an investigative reporter, and there's nothing in your newspaper about this. Now, bear in mind, this is December 2005, 15, 16 months after Risen had the story, okay? Now, what happens? Sulzberger and the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times go to the Oval Office and explain their dilemma to George W. Bush. It's going to be really embarrassing, they say. And Bush says, I don't agree. This is state secrets. You can't do this. And they said, come on, Mr. President. We held off so you could, well, so that wouldn't interfere with the election in 2004. And now, we're going to have to, well, I don't agree. So they leave and they publish it. And what happens, of course, is all hell breaks loose, except New York Times escapes any opprobrium because they did what they knew had to be done because they, quote, know what's best for the American people. Now, this is a syndrome here. And my colleague, Robert Perry, who heads up consortiumnews.com, something that's been in existence now longer than any investigative website, he tells a story about having won all manner of prizes for uncovering the Iran-Contra affair. Okay, he becomes quite a celebrity, and he leaves AP to work with Newsweek, and he's invited as a young advancing reporter to go to one of these soirees where corporate comes down from New York and, you know, they could meet in and this was a small group of 13 people. And they had a young congressman there from Wyoming. That name was Richard Cheney. And they had Scowcroft, who had just left his job from the National Security Advisor. And so, as Bob explains it, and this is really a telling story, he's sitting there next to the head of Newsweek, for whom he's working, okay? And Scowcroft, apropos of nothing in particular, says, well, my successor, Admiral Poindexter, he's going before Congress on Tuesday, and I would advise him to tell Congress that we never told the president anything about this Iran-Contra thing. And Bob Perry, being new to these circles, drops his fork right into his shrimp cocktail and makes a little clatter, and not thinking says, General Scowcroft, did I hear you say that you would advise your successor to perjure himself before Congress? Now, Bob says, the silence seemed like it lasted 3 minutes, but it's probably only about a half a minute. And then the head of Newsweek put his arm around me and he said, now, Bob,
And he said, where are you working next week?
No, he said, now, Bob, sometimes
you have to do what's best for the country. And then everybody went, gentlemanly laughter. There wasn't a woman in the thing. Sometimes you have to do what's best for the country.
You're listening to part two of a conversation with Ray McGovern on Other Voices, Other Choices. Ray McGovern is an ex-CIA analyst who is better known these days as a peace activist. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. You can find both parts one and two on othervoicesotherchoices.com and on the YouTube channel of the same name.
Okay, so that's the attitude. They know what's best for the country. So unless we find some constructive, inventive, imaginative ways to counter that and to dislodge all my former colleagues from university in New York from the notion that if they read the New York Times, they know what's going on, because so many still believe that. Unless we can dislodge them from that and get them accustomed to looking in the correct places for real news on the internet and the web, unless we can do that, I actually do fear now with this new administration that we'll be going the way of Germany in the 1930s.
Yeah, you know, I have several friends who are still into that the New York Times is objective and tells the truth kind of thing. And if I ever say, well, I saw this or that on RT or, you know, an alternative site, they'll say, oh, yeah, well, that's you can't believe what they say because they're state media or they're connected with this other group or something. But yet they believe the New York Times. And because of the state corporate nexus, all corporate media in this country are actually organs of the state to a large degree. And they've aside from that, they've all been bought out by the CIA long ago. So I don't know how you get through to people who want to believe that, for example, the New York Times is telling them the truth. And unless we do get over that, we won't get anywhere.
Well, that's true. And, you know, being a New Yorker, it's no less than profoundly sad what's happened to the New York Times. My parents were first-generation Irish immigrants. But they never would go to bed at night without having finished reading the New York Times. Now, I mean this. I mean, if they got too tired, if they were watching TV or something and just couldn't stay awake, they had a special place to put that day's Times in for the next morning, and they wouldn't dare touch today's Times until they had finished yesterday's Times. That's how sacrosanct it was. Now, when I go up to my university was Fordham, and many of my friends are still alive. You know, we meet every 5 years. And I was up there for our 50th a couple of years ago, and we were treated to a lecture by a four-star general who was in the celebrating his 45th. His name was Jack, and I'll remember his last name in a second, but he was the general behind the surge in Iraq, okay? And he was telling us all manner of things. He made a little lecture after the picnic. Now, I'm proud of having done one very self-sacrificial thing, and that is I didn't have a beer at the picnic because I wanted to be completely sober when Jack was giving his little presentation. And sure enough, what he said was, he was all dressed up, you know, in these fancy shirts that, you know, have the two colors now. They have one color for the collar and they have stripes. And you know, I have to get me one of them. Anyhow, he's all dressed up. You know, I'm going out to JFK right now and I'm going out to Europe and tell them that they're really being very, very capricious and not realizing the danger of Iran getting a nuclear weapon because they're right on the verge of it. And if we don't wake up these Europeans, a terrible thing's going to happen. So I raised my hand, you know, and all my colleagues are there. And he wouldn't recognize. And finally, he recognized, I'm Ray McGovern. I work for the CIA. General, can you be unaware of the fact that the intelligence community 3 years ago in 2007 came to a unanimous conclusion, all 16 agencies expressed with high confidence that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on the weapon, and that judgment has been reasserted every year since? Can you be unaware of that?
And he looked at me and he says, Mr. McGovern, I have my own sources.
And Wilton, I lost it. I that's a lie, okay? Whoa, the dean was not pleased. Jack is now on the board of overseers. And my friends, well, they didn't know what to believe. And this is the hard part, you know? They thought, well, McGovern, he did graduate summa cum laude. We thought he was a pretty bright guy. But how can he say this kind of thing to Jack, General Jack? And how? We don't see it in the New York Times. I mean, hello? McGovern's asking us to believe McGovern when it's not in the New York Times? And Jack is saying this? So I kid you not, I lost some friends that way.
So they prefer to believe that general over the findings of 16 intelligence agencies.
Yeah, and it's just because
it's because they live in a non-fact-based universe at this point.
That's one way of putting it, yeah. But more specifically, it's the New York Times that has had this wonderful reputation over the years, the newspaper of record. You know, it's kind of like a privilege sort of thing. If you have a tie and a collar and better still a shirt with two colors to it, and you read the New York Times every day, well, you are ipso facto in the cognoscenti there in New York and surroundings. And that's kind of too bad because our country needs educated people to be truly educated. And if they're malnourished on information of great consequence, as has been the case for these last couple of decades, what Jefferson said when he was asked, you know, Mr. President, Mr. Thomas Jefferson, if you had to choose between a government and a free press, what would your choice be? And without thinking is, of course, the free press, because without a free press, a government ipso facto becomes a dictatorship. That is the case, and we're close to that now.
Well, I think it's necessary for the corporations to have an ignorant population because otherwise we'd rise up. So they want us to be smart enough to run the machines, but not to question why the machines. You know, why are we doing this policy? They want us to be able to serve their needs, but no more than that.
Yeah, and the correspondents, the journalists. You know, take a young person coming out of Columbia Journalism School, School of Journalism. He wants to get a job. He wants to have a decent living. He's got to conform.
He's got a debt to pay.
Yeah.
Student loan.
So the system is, whether it's intentionally rigged this way, you know, I don't know, sometimes these things happen through a whole bunch of coincidences or other things, but the reality is that if you want to be a journalist in this day and age, you've got to be really exceptional and put up with not making a lot of money. Because I have nothing but the highest respect for Bill Moyers, okay? Take Bill Moyers. He drank the Kool-Aid on Russian hacking to undermine Hillary Clinton. He and Winship, they're right.
Yeah, I haven't kept up with him, but I'm sorry to hear that because I do have enormous respect for him myself.
But, you know, who has the time to pursue alternative sources when the New York Times? This is an interesting thing here. There's a fellow named David Sanger, and he writes for the New York Times. And he was pretty much a partner of Judy Miller before the war in Iraq. And as you know, they were printing all manner of flat fact statements about the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I have a chance to come up to Fordham Law School to listen to David Sanger on a panel talking about various and sundry, especially Stuxnet, which he knows a lot about. And there was a film that was shown, Zero Something, quite an interesting film. So
That was the virus that infected the Iranian centrifuges,
right?
Right,
that was the virus developed by the Israelis and us to actually destroy, not infect, but destroy centrifuges in the Iranian nuclear development programs, even though there was no proof that they were heading for a nuclear weapon. So,
just as an aside, I understand that that virus is now commercially available if you have enough money to pay for it.
Well, suffice it to say that I did a little homework on Sanger because I remembered vaguely what a role he played before Iraq with Judy Miller. And I uncovered an article he had done on the 29th of July in which he asserted no fewer than six times that it was flat fact that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So we're talking 2002, the preparation for the war, and the date is July 29. Now, people should know that 9 days earlier, our director of Central Intelligence at the time, George Tenet, told his British counterpart, Sir Richard Dearlove, who came to Langley, CIA headquarters, to get the real message, and Tenet told him, ha, weapons of mass destruction, that's a crock, as we say in Queens or the Bronx. There aren't any. We're just making believe there are, and we are, quote, fixing the intelligence around the policy, end quote. Now, how do I know that? Well, number one, I had some friends there. They weren't privy to this very private conversation. But number two, Dearlove goes back to brief Tony Blair on the 23rd of July, 2002, and he spills the beans, and his most important statement was, George Bush has decided to attack Iraq for regime change. The attack will be justified by the conjunction of terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. A translation from the British, we will say he has all manner of weapons of mass destruction and that he's about to give them to terrorists. Okay, and then the crowning sentence, but the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy, end quote.
Wouldn't be the first time.
No. So what am I saying here? Well, that's the 20th when Tenet met with Dearlove. Okay, the 29th, David Sanger is talking about weapons of mass destruction as though it is flat fact. And so I had a chance to, I like to ask questions from the audience. I had a chance to ask Sanger. I said, now, David Sanger, we know that George Tenet was talking to the press. How do you square your conscience with the fact that he told his British counterpart that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction on the 20th of July, 2002, and then he told you or your colleagues, and you put it in your article for everybody to read, that there were weapons of mass destruction. Now, now you're doing the same thing. You're doing exactly the same thing with all this stuff about Russia hacking. Are you getting your information from John Brennan, whose patron was George Tenet, John Brennan, the outgoing CIA director. So why do you keep doing this? Now, everybody there at Fordham Law School was believing what the New York Times says. And there was a lot of grumbling. And I turned around. I said, look, I forgive you guys. You read the New York Times like I did when I used to live up here, and you believe it. So, no hard feelings. I understand why this is news to you. But this guy has a record, and you should expose it. So it's so transparent what's going on here. The people like Sanger are making big bucks for doing what the government dictates, and that's a sad, sad outcome for what used to be a pretty good newspaper.
Right. They're people of what I would call low integrity. Speaking of the Russian hacking, I went to the Women's March on Washington on the 21st of January, and amazingly huge crowds, and it was really uplifting to see people coming out like that. But I saw a lot of signs about Trump is
working for Putin, or, you know, the Russian hacking and all the supposedly the scandals and that kind of thing. And it seems to me people are out there demonstrating against Trump, but they don't really understand really what's going on. They are buying the lies about the Russian hacking, et cetera. And I just think we've got a long way, you know, a lot of work to do to get to where people believe the truth of the matter.
Yeah, they're not so automatically exposed to it. Now, Sanger, as I said, is one of the lead authors promoting this notion that, number one, the Russians hacked and shared that information with WikiLeaks in a deliberate attempt, approved by President Putin, no less, to undermine Hillary Clinton so that Donald Trump would win the election. Now, there are so many things wrong with that. First and foremost, you know, as I think I've said, I've been watching Russian leaders for 60 years. That's 6-0 now. I think I know a little bit about how they look at the world. And if I'm Putin, and I'm sitting there in the Kremlin, and I'm watching Hillary Clinton, and I'm watching Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is actually bragging about how unpredictable he is, okay? He's taking all kinds of accolades for being unpredictable, and he shows himself to be very short-tempered. He'll lash out at the least real or imagined slight. Now, I'm Vladimir Putin. Is this the kind of guy I want with his finger on the nuclear codes or the nuclear button, whatever it is?
Now this reminds me of the Nixon madman theory. Are you familiar with that?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, he purposely wanted to come across as hot-tempered and impulsive as a deliberate policy to scare the Russians.
Yeah. But, you know, on this notion here, I am, you know, morally certain that Vladimir Putin has no special in with the Almighty or with the Holy Spirit that would have told him, hey, Vlad, Trump's going to win. You can help Trump win.
Right.
I think Putin, like everybody else on this planet that had that read the polls and analyzed this thing, thought that Hillary's going to win. So one conclusion I draw from that is, if that's your conclusion or that's your assumption, what percentage is there in hacking into Hillary Clinton's emails, the Democratic National Committee emails, and all that kind of stuff, when you're pretty sure she's going to win? Now, that's not a conclusive sort of thing, but when you look at how it went down and how Putin and the others, you look at I still follow the Russian media. Their TV is much more tightly controlled than their radio or their other media, newspapers. But their TV was just, 90% sure that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And so what am I saying? I'm saying that I believe that Putin sat back and he had the same attitude as I was in Germany when the election took place. My German friends would say, it's eine Wahl zwischen Pest und Cholera, which means it's a choice between plague and cholera. In other words, as we put it in this country, there's no lesser evil. And that's exactly why I was so happy to be able to vote for somebody I really admire, and that's Jill Stein.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I did that too.
She asked me to endorse her before the election, and I said, I'm happy to, Jill. And what I put up was this. I said, look, I have 9 grandchildren. For me, this is a choice between slow death for my grandchildren. And I say this with profound sorrow, because when they're my age, the chances are very good they're not going to have clean water to drink or clean air to breathe, okay? That's one choice. That's Trump. Or the possibility of perhaps not so slow a death, but a destructive death by pushing the Russians too far and the Hillary Clinton. And that's right. How I saw it. That's no lesser evil there. And what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, my God, it looks like looks like this guy was not just saying these things. It looks like he's going to follow through on everything, including torture and other stuff. So yeah, that's why Jill, I thought, was a terrific. I mean, the environment is the issue if you care at all about what comes after us. And anybody with grandchildren, I don't see how anybody in Congress who has grandchildren can be against looking into global warming.
I think they just have to be psychopaths. How can they ignore the warning signs?
I guess you can always believe what you want to believe, and as long
if you're paid enough to believe it.
Yeah, I don't know if you haven't had a good science course since 1913, you know, and you want to believe the few dishonest ones that are left. You're right. If you want to believe them, you can.
I think we should probably wrap up pretty soon. Is there anything you want to say in summary?
Yes. You know, I'm asked often why I keep doing what I'm doing. You know, I'm 77. I really would like to spend more time with my grandchildren. But I feel that by virtue of my 27 years at the CIA, 2 years with the military, and lots of stuff in between, that I have a certain obligation to try to spread some truth around. And so I'm going to keep doing that, whether here or in Europe or wherever, as long as I'm physically fit to do that. Now, people say, yeah, but you're not getting any results, McGovern. You know, you get these delusions of grandeur. Nobody's listening to you, you know. Well, I think of my old friend Dan Berrigan. Now, I wasn't a very close friend of his, but I took two retreats under him, and he knew who I was, and we met a couple of times. Right before he died, I met him. And what he said after he did that major action in that little place in Maryland there, 1968, Catonsville.
You talking about breaking into the draft board and burning the records?
Yeah, they got the draft cards, and they burnt them with the homemade napalm.
Yeah, there's video of that on YouTube.
Yeah, they waited around for the cops to come. And so Dan explains he's in they took him to the only federal building in Catonsville, Maryland, which happens to be the post office, right? So they're sitting around there, and there are about nine of them. And Dan says, you know, I'm reflecting here, and I'm saying, this was a big thing. This was a big act that we just did. Now, was it worth it? I mean, people are going to call me a commie, going to call me foolish, going to call me crazy. Was it worth doing? And Dan says, you know, I came to the realization that, yes, it was worth doing. The good is worth doing because it's good. Now results, they're not unimportant, but they're secondary. They're secondary to the goodness of the act. And he said, you know, I had a great feeling of relief there because success, yeah, it's not unimportant, but it's secondary. And he said, I breathe a sigh of relief. And then, as only Dan could, he's writing this in his diary, his book, which is really great. Anyhow, he's writing this and he says, and just then in comes a paradigm of an FBI inspector. Shoves open the door, he looks around, and my brother Phil, he says, is still in his clerics. You know, he says, Phil was a priest too. And he looks at Phil and he says, you again. I'll change my religion. And Dan writes, no higher compliment could come to my brother Phil. See? So two lessons from this. Results, not unimportant, but secondary. The witness is what speaks to people. And secondly, for God's sake, keep your sense of humor. Without a sense of humor, you're not going to be long for this journey. And Dan Berrigan was the paragon of that for me and taught me that you keep plugging and success is really not always in your hands. You try to do good and then you leave it to successors or to God to figure out what's best for the world. The last thing I'll say is another prophet, Cesar Chavez, put this into real words for me. You know, he used to say, look, you know, thanks a lot for those articles. Oh, they're great. And their speeches, oh, that's wonderful. But nothing's going to happen without action. Okay? Now, you say, well, there aren't enough of us. Well, there are enough of us. But nothing's going to happen without action. And so he's right. And that's why I think we're at the point where we need to put our bodies into it. Now, if you're as old as I am, and you have the color hair that I do, which is pretty gray by now, I would reassure people that that's an advantage. Right? Now, how's that work? Well, I've been beaten up a couple times, once by Hillary Clinton's goons, and I got pretty badly beat up. And guess what? The State Department was flooded with thousands of calls and emails and everything. Why? Because Americans don't like old people to get beat up. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, young people, they got to come in some that. Why are you doing away the young? But old people. So, if you're an old people, if you're like me, you have a big advantage. They're not going to kill you. They may mess you up a little bit, but they're not going to break your leg if you're lucky. Show these young people how important all this stuff is. Have we forgotten about Vietnam? Have we forgotten about how we had to do this in the past? Show them. You have this advantage. Put it into play, and you'll see that young people will take notice and say, whoa, well, let's look into this. Maybe these old guys know something we don't know.
Okay, and with that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks so much for being on my show, Ray, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too, Wilton.
You've been listening to part two of a conversation with Ray McGovern on Other Voices, Other Choices. We spoke via Skype on January 26, 2017. You can find both parts one and two on othervoicesotherchoices.com and on the YouTube channel of the same name. I'm going to end this episode with audio I recorded at the Women's March on Washington, D.C. on January 21st, 2017.
The women united will never be defeated. The women united will never be defeated.
We shall not
be moved.
We shall not
be moved,
just like a tree that's standing by the water.